Hi, I'm Tracy.
And I'm Sharon, and we are Feet of Clay.
Confessions of the Cult Sisters.
Today is part two of our deep dive into, Tracy, I think it's like, I think it's a bottomless pit that we call The Demise of Last Days Ministries.
In part one, we tried to stay with a big picture overview, although Sharon, we did hop down a few little rabbit trails in that episode.
Ouch, ouch. Yep. Okay. Guilty. I am guilty as charged.
And for our alert listeners, which I guess this is versus the sleepy listeners.
Wait, are they asleep in the light?
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. Between part one and this being part two, we did a real live episode, which was great. We just recorded in the car on the way to visiting the old property of Last Days Ministries in Texas, where you and I met each other for the first time.
Yeah. And Tracy, that was really an amazing trip together. I mean, it was just to me special beyond words to have that time with you in person once again in that place that was so pivotal in our lives.
Yes. And for me, I had had some business travel already sandwiched in between that. I had travel for my new grandbaby, as you mentioned in episode 36. And yet I was like, I have to make this work. I have to find a way to get into Dallas and spend that. And so glad I did, though. We really packed in a lot in I think it was a day and a half.
I know. It was crazy how much we covered in those 36 hours or whatever. So, all right. Well, everybody, we've been working really hard on putting together outlines and bullet points for this series. As we continue with part two, Tracy, and however many following episodes are going to be in this demise series, I really don't know how many, but it's going to be a lot. I think it's important that we give ourselves a lot of flexibility to wander down, you know, kind of like all the nooks and crannies and every little rabbit trail that might pop up along the way. So, Tracy, I've got this, like, my own personal battle cry that I'm going to hold on to as we attack this subject. Freedom! You know what that's from?
I was going to say, is your face half painted blue, maybe, when you're crying that? Oh, my God. So did you also have a crush on Mel Gibson from Braveheart? Oh. That was one of the few movies, for whatever reason, I guess because it's war and slaughter, it's okay for Christians to watch. Have a crush on Mel Gibson from that, like I did.
Oh, my God. That is... Okay, it's very embarrassing, and I'm not sure why you're going to ask me that, but yeah.
I don't think Mel Gibson's embarrassing. He was a hot hottie.
No, he was hot, but what's embarrassing about it, though, is it's that kind of, again, that little girl romantic, right? That just fairy tale dream thing, you know?
Yeah, there were definitely some very mild sex scenes in it, but it was steamy and evocative for definitely the little girl in us. Well, my little girl crush is also Sully from Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. I have a theme going on with the manly men with long hair. You probably never even watched that.
I have never, I admit, I have never, never seen that show. But, okay. Oh. I am not embarrassed. This is a little weird, maybe a little twisted. So I am not embarrassed. I'm actually kind of proud about the two other main crushes I had, which you've already recently highlighted on Instagram. And that
were you so excited that I did that I knew you so well that I found that?
I couldn't believe you found that. It's like, how did you find? I thought you made it up, like AI or something. But but it's Gene Wilder of Willy Wonka and Young Frankenstein fame. And of course, the incomparable, the amazing Tim Curry as Frankenfurter in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And okay, so I'm sure you think I'm a little strange, but I don't know. To me, Tracy, there is something really appealing to me about those just smart, sexy, quirky kind of guys.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very cutting edge crushes for someone in purity culture. Just going to say that.
And, right.
For listeners, I will repost it because it's this puppet artist that has these two string puppets that are both Tim Curry and Gene Wilder. And when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, I have to find this for Sharon.
If you really loved me, Tracy, you would buy those puppets
for
me.
I know. They're probably like one of a kind, thousands of dollars. But you're worth it. You're worth it. All right, Sharon, I think this isn't just dashing down. We think we've fallen into a rabbit hole on this one.
All right. Yep. That was random. I'll give it to you. That was random for sure. But some of the rabbit trails we're going to hop down, they will be meaningful and very important. So, all right, everybody, we are going to go, like we said, really in depth on this topic of the demise of Last Days Ministries. And Tracy and I have both said, I think to you all already, but to each other for sure, we want to do this one time. We want to do it justice, but we want to do it one time only and then be done with it.
Be done with it. Yeah. Do you remember 3 years, 4 years when we got together to discuss doing a book together?
Oh, yeah. That was a good time. And it was overwhelming, actually.
So I guess this is what we're going to do instead. We're just going to have like a verbal book and be done with it.
And be done with it. Okay. And that's why we're going to give ourselves that total freedom to follow any bunny trail that seems relevant and could shed more light into these dark, dark corners. So you're up for that, right, Tracy?
Yes. And of course, our listeners, there's always that handy dandy little fast forward button that you have on your podcast if we get too much off track. And also you can go into fast mode as well. So,
oh yeah. Listen to it on a higher speed. I do that a lot.
Yeah. I do that a lot as well. So we are actually calling this series our Eras Tour, not to be confused with Eros Tour, which I now think we have to do, Sharon, for those deconstructing years. More to come on that.
We'll go. Yeah, we can do that.
But our eras are as follows. Number one, Keith Green, Blazing Bright. Number two, The Reign and Regime of Melody Green. Number three, Touch, Not God's Anointed. Number four, That Goddamn Mountains Mandate, although I don't think the GD is in the title, but maybe it should be.
Should be.
And number five, The Hidden Years. And then finally, my favorite, Zombieland.
Zombieland. I so love that you came up with zombies. I totally love
you know,
that.
It's such a tendency. And already, I don't know if you've been aware, this last week alone, our dear friends at IHOP Kansas City, there's already talk of them ending and closing down some parts of the ministry, but wait for it, and reopening it with a new goddamn name.
Right,
so,
right.
I don't know what it is about these spaces that they don't ever want to close, shut the doors.
Right.
So those damn zombies.
Damn zombies.
We realize that before we can do the deep dive into the demise of Last Days Ministries, we actually need to kind of tell you what Last Days was all about. Not just what we've said so far, but in theory. And in reality, especially for those listeners who might not have been so caught up in this as we were. And I promise you all, it's relevant, right? The more we kind of unpack this and I look back, I'm seeing how relevant it is to what's happening still in these spaces today.
Amen, sister. Amen.
Amen. Oh, my God. So we're starting this one with era number one, Keith Green, Blazing Bright, which goes from 1977 to July of 1982.
Right. When it ended with a literal crash and a literal ball of fire. So, yeah. But wait, hang on. Before we even get started with this first era, Tracy, I made a little note to myself. Here's my initial bunny trail.
Oh my God, already. So, you know, you may not know this, but I was actually born in the year of the rabbit in Chinese zodiac.
Oh, no, I didn't know
what
that.
What year you were born in under? What animal?
Well, I know what year I was born, but no.
Well, 19... you know what animal it is?
No, no, no. Look it up. It's 1961.
Okay, well, all I'm saying is it's not, well, you go into your bunny trail, I'll look it up, but okay. I don't think you even have an excuse for this.
Okay. All right. Okay. Okay, I get it. But I do think that this is important. You know, like I said, well, we've told people too. I mean, we're trying to do a lot of research. We're putting together outlines and bullet points and all that kind of stuff. And I've realized as I reflect back on this first era of Keith Green, Tracy, I've got these like complicated and conflicting thoughts and emotions that are just kind of all intertwined. And I got to admit, there's definitely some cognitive dissonance going on in me. So despite everything I see now of the bullshit and the abuse, and trust me, I see it. I totally see it for what it is. And yet there's this little part of me that still admires and values some of that radical, all for Jesus, all things in common stuff, right? So, like, I don't know if it's just generalized nostalgia or teenage idealism, but sometimes, and sometimes this happens when Dave and I are talking, I find myself kind of wanting to, like, defend the... I don't know. I mean, oh shit. I mean, I just kind of want to call it the goodness. Was there goodness in that of what we were seeking and what we were doing? But then of course there's this older and hopefully wiser and definitely more aware part of me that sees the awfulness of the core message, which basically boils down to God is good and we are shit. Mm-hmm. So Tracy, that is my huge cognitive dissonance, like how to square the fact that I still have fond memories with the reality that this absurd belief system led to all these abusive behaviors that we were victims of and we participated in and perpetuated.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot.
It is a lot. And then, okay, but wait, there's more. There's more. So there's this other part, and it's anger. But it's not just anger at the bullshit. This is the weird part of it. I think about how angry I was back then in 1986 and then 1987, right after we were kicked out, and things at Last Days were really going off the rails. And I've got to confess that even now, every once in a while, I still kind of feel that anger. But that anger is about what Melody and YWAM did to distort and corrupt Keith's original vision, what Last Days Ministries was before the plane crash. So that means I'm looking at all this, and I've got to face the fact that maybe I still really value that original vision, which just makes me want to say to myself, what the fuck, Sharon? What the fuck?
Wow. I have so many thoughts.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. Okay, so I'll just say this last thing and then you can let me have it. On the one hand, I've started to think that maybe what I thought the original vision was, in actuality, was not the real vision. Or at the very least, it was not the lived, experienced reality of what the words claimed it should be. And then, on the other hand, I think, holy shit, Sharon, are you still wearing tinted glasses all these decades later to think that any of that was okay?
Wow. I personally don't think this is a side trail at all. I think, actually, this goes to the very heart of what we're doing in these podcasts, right? That goes very much to the heart, Sharon, of why we even went at first, right? Mm-hmm. Who we became while we were there, and then why we slowly kind of kept drinking the Kool-Aid, we could say, or were beginning to morph into this vision that was different than when we first went.
Mm-hmm.
And I think why still so many today, people that we met on our trip, as well as people that we know who reach out to us, they cannot bring themselves at all to really call out the shit, right, that we were all a part of.
Mm-hmm.
I do think this is the heart of why we're even doing this podcast, and that there's going to be more, enlightenment to that as we continue to dive in. But I would rather let's dive in, and then as those things emerge, we can kind of point them out and, you know, say how I think I see this in the IHOP Kansas City people.
You know,
they're wanting to close down this prayer, this 24/7 prayer, and yet there are people that are emotionally attached to that, and there really is that cognitive dissonance. And
right. And
ultimately, I think as we get into the era of the times on, you know, all the hippie-esque movies where Jesus is this cool dude just calling all these people to follow him, I think there's just a lot packed into that.
Okay.
So I think that means we should get started.
Okay, woman.
We should get started with era number one, Keith Green, blazing bright in all his hippie coolness, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
From 1977 in California until the tragic fiery plane crash in Texas on July 28, 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to kind of cover this and not repeat all the different things that we've said, we're going to refer people back to some episodes from season one, so they can get caught up. If you're a newer listener and you haven't already kind of gone back to season one, we really encourage you to do so. We've covered lots of different aspects from my interview with I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist to your interview with Troy and Brian, and really tried to paint that picture of the private reality of Keith Green versus his public Christian prophet megastar persona.
Right. And we're going to put the links in the show notes for all those relevant episodes. Again, yep, really encourage you to listen. You'll get the detailed sense of what it was really like behind the scenes in the orbit of Keith Green. These include episode one, was Keith Green a cult leader? That's Tracy's story. Shall we say testimony? Would that be your testimony, Tracy?
That's my testimony.
Number three, Keith Green arranged my teenage marriage. That's my story. 15 and 16, those are our interview with Keith's foster daughter, Dawn, who lived with him from age 10 on and is the only living person who ever experienced Keith as a parent. Then number 23, Keith Green Acres.
Where you get to hear Sharon and I sing the intro. Like, that's worth it right there.
Worth the price of admission, free.
Sure.
Anyway, in that we paint a picture of both the hilarious and the horrible reality of our ranch commune life.
Yeah. And can I just say, so in episode 37, when you and I go back in real time to the property and we kind of tour the area and there's all of these, you know, ministry spaces, I was envisioning all the animals. That is what we had that was separate from all the ministries, was the life on the ranch.
We did.
With all the animals and peach orchards and wow.
Yep.
It was something to think about.
Another way in which we miserably failed, for sure.
Yes.
All right. And then number 24, we've got an interview with Paul, who was one of the brothers at Last Days Ministries, gives his really in-depth insight. And number 14, the one to end with on that, is the plane crash that killed Keith Green. Again, folks, these are behind-the-scenes facts about this tragic event, rather than the sanitized, whitewashed version that has been put out to the world. And it includes taking a hard look at Keith's own culpability in that tragedy. So, All right, Tracy. Boy, see, I'm going on and on. Era number one, Keith Green burning bright. If you had to sum it up, I almost said in 50 words or less, but you can use more words than that.
Oh, wow. How generous of you.
Of course, darling, anytime. Okay, so how...
I think you took my 50 in that recap of the episode. Just saying.
It was more like 500. All right. How would you describe the original vision of Last Days Ministries, that message and the method or whatever you want to call it that drew us there?
Wow. Well, the first word that comes to mind is intense, right? And that would eventually be called the training school that people would come to, intensive Christian training.
Right.
And there's a huge joke that went around at the beginning as people would say, you know, what do you think about Last Days School? And it's like, oh, it's intense. I mean, everything out of our mouth was it's intense. And so somebody really thought we held the school in pitched tents.
No, that was Teen Mania later, wasn't it?
I know. They did it in Quonset huts. And it's like, so they ended up taking it to another level. But we're no. So this like joke went on for a while because no. We weren't actually living in tents. But the ministry life itself was just so intense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with that, it's that sold out abandonment to Jesus, no compromise, right? That really should go to the top of the list because Keith kind of defined it that way.
Yep, yep.
And everything that you have completely just like, what's that song? Burned out for thee. You're going to be not just sold out, but you're going to burn yourself out.
Oh, right, right. The lamp of my life is burned out for thee.
Yes. Yeah. That was our mantra. Like we would like cry that from our souls. And then of course, you know, that you can't ever charge anything, which is the part that I liked that drew me that, you know, everything is for whatever you can afford.
Yeah. Yeah. That was good. Yeah. No compromise. I think you're right. That is a great summation, which of course was the name of Keith's second album. And then the name of the book that Melody wrote, I can't call it a biography. It's really a how do you say that word, Tracy?
Hagiography. Yeah.
Hagiography. Right. Skewed and colored and all that. But yeah. I think a more fitting word, and I've said this before, is no boundaries. That was really the problem.
That's so good. I think you reiterated that on our recent trip to somebody. And I was like, that is a great title. And I think very accurate.
Yeah. All right. Shall we get started on our bullet point summary? So starting out.
By the way, Sharon needs these bullet points to keep her on the trail.
Yeah, I do.
All right, go for your bullet points.
I do, but even with them, I'm gonna wander.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the freedom, Sharon. So you were born under the you said 1961, right?
Yeah, 61.
I don't know if you're gonna edit that or if you want people to know that that's.
Yeah, that's all right. That's how old I am. Yeah,
the year of the ox.
So. Of the ox. Oh. Do you remember? Ooh, we used to quote this scripture. Mm-hmm. Fun fact, I remember we quoted this scripture and it was about Keith. Holy shit, I haven't thought about this in decades. There's a proverb that says, let me see if I can get it right. Where there is no ox, the manger is clean, but much benefit comes from the strength of the ox, something to that effect, with the general idea that, yeah, you got this bull in a china shop type character that shits out a lot of shit, but also gets a lot done. So
gets a lot done. So when I saw that, yes, definitely can see the labor intensity of the ox for sure.
Yes. Okay. Back to my bullet. I need my first bullet point. So Last Days was born out of the whole hippie Jesus movement, right? We're talking love and brotherhood and peace. And this was the age of Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar and Brother Sun, Sister Moon.
Brother Sun, Sister Moon. So I don't think we can overestimate the impact of this on the culture, first of all. And I was only 10 when I saw Brother Sun, Sister Moon. And I happened to be living in Italy at the time. So it's by Frank Zeffirelli, I think, is the director. So it's got a lot of the Italian landscape, which a lot of us went to. But I was riveted. And I would liken it to like that little girl love that we talk about. It's almost like a little girl love porn movie. And listeners, if you should look up the trailer. It's kind of hilarious. But at the time, Claire becomes one of the nuns in the Franciscan. Catholic history correct in that, but she has to cut her hair in devotion to God. And I remember leaving that theater and I had this long, 70s hair and just wrestling. I wasn't what I would call myself a Christian at that time, but it was still the groundwork of my heart of, would you cut your hair for God? And I just wrestled with that cost. From Brother Sun, Sister Moon.
What year was that? What year were you 10 years old?
1973. So I need to look up and make sure the movie tracks with that.
That was the year that I saw Jesus Christ Superstar in the theaters. And I was I 12? Was I 13? Maybe it was 74. I might have that all wrong, but.
Yeah. So Brother Sun, Sister Moon came out in 72. So I do track with that.
Okay. I didn't see Brother Sun, Sister Moon. I've still never seen it. So I will put it on my list to watch sometime in the next few weeks.
Be prepared to laugh hysterically now.
But Jesus Christ Superstar, now that has held the test of time. I mean, that is, to me, it's still one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, it came out in 1973, Sharon. So okay. That tracks as well.
Yep. That's when I was watching it. And I think I've told you this before, Tracy. The scene where Jesus is being whipped, I wept in that theater. I just bawled my eyes out. And what was going through my mind was, he is innocent and good. I'm the one who deserves to be whipped. Wow. I'm the one who deserves to be whipped. So, I think that good Catholic upbringing early on was a good primer.
Yeah. And that's, why I say I don't think we can discount what was happening in our culture, right?
Right.
The year of the hippies, the Jesus movement, you have these very cool figures in Godspell, Jesus Christ Superstar, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, just really eschewing materialism, right? And I would see that hook for me coming in the later years, just I wanted something more than the materialism of the world. So
right.
Keep going.
So that's a time that, like, since Keith was in his late teens, he began this spiritual quest of sorts, and he becomes enamored with Jesus. And then he, according to himself, quote, gets saved around May of 1975 at the age of 21.
Wow. Yeah. So he was probably taken in by all of these cultural figures as well.
I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. So in August of 1975, just a few months later, Sharon, he comes to stay at your house in Tucson, Arizona. So you had already seen Jesus Christ Superstar by this time.
Yep. The year before.
Already had that sense of you are guilty for wherever that really has come from.
Right.
And at 14 years old, you're prime then to basically get saved.
Yep. It was about 10 days after my 14th birthday. Yep.
So I know that you do talk about this in another episode, but I still have some questions.
Okay.
So Jesus Christ Superstar, you feel the whipping part of Jesus, but there's also, it's a rock musical, right?
Oh, which has
amazing music in it. That's very gripping. I will say to listeners that I saw the reunion tour of Jesus Christ Superstar. I guess it was 50 years later. How old we are. And I think I texted my children as I was leaving the live theater. It's Broadway touring. I was like, I'm ready to get saved again. Like, that's how rousing that musical score is. It's just,
it is
impactful. So with Keith in your living room playing music, he's got the look. I mean, you tell the story of going barefoot and standing on a Bible. Was there any kind of just a draw from just the whole vibe that
well, yeah. There? Yeah. I mean, it's this, it's this hippie culture. It's this counterculture. It's this radical, we're going to talk about love and peace and brotherhood. And yeah, it was like going back to this radical dude, Jesus. And Keith personified that, absolutely mm-hmm. personified it.
Wow. Yeah, it's powerful, especially for a 14, you were 14, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. a 14-year-old girl's heart. I think when you do watch Brothers and Sister Moomin, you're going to get it.
Okay. Okay.
Like, there's one scene where she's running through the wildflowers, like after this Franciscan monk, who, by the way, for everybody, they're celibate. Like, these are celibate monks. It's a nun and a boy who will be celibate, and they just make eye contact. It's the most flirtatious show ever. So.
Okay. I look forward to it. All right. Well, so Keith's got this house on Dolorosa Street, which isn't that ironic, Tracy? Dolorosa? Mm-hmm. Remember that whole, did Sandy Patty sing Via Dolorosa?
I do. I don't know if our listeners know, but go on, make the connection.
Dolorosa Street, it's the red pain, you know, it's the way of the cross. It's that whole Jesus carrying the cross through the streets and bleeding. So,
wow.
His house is on Dolorosa Street in Woodland Hills, California. And he's taking people into his home to help them out, but mostly, you know, to proselytize, to push them towards believing in Jesus.
Yeah. So, you know what I see? I see Godspell in reality. That's right. What I see, right? Because he's a musician. I mean, the guy like playing, it's the total visual
total.
Of this musician basically leading this trail of people to Jesus. And so, yeah, he's doing concerts anywhere he can. And I think what we don't really talk a lot about is his marketing genius, or at least his being a marketeer way before his time.
Yeah.
So as he's doing all of these concerts, what's he doing? He's collecting the names and addresses, brilliant, from mm-hmm. everyone who attends his concerts, already having the idea that he would be able to promote future albums, stay in contact with these people. I mean, he was data collecting before it was a thing.
That is true. That is true. Cutting edge for his time.
Yes.
So as time goes on, it becomes really obvious, Tracy, that these names and addresses, they are worth far more than any one-time cash offering that he might have asked for, right? These names are gold. Gold.
So brilliant. It's so brilliant. So Keith records his first album on Sparrow Records. And it's called For Him Who Has Ears to Hear in early 1977. So, mm-hmm. Sharon, this is before you went there, but you'd already had him at your house. Were you familiar with that album at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we used to write back and forth, and he came through Arizona, I think, on his tour before the album. And then he had mailed me a copy of the album. Okay, so, yeah, I was totally.
So you got it.
All yeah. Right.
And what did you think of? Do you remember what you
Oh, I thought it was great. I thought it was amazing. I played it over and over. I memorized every word. It was my worship album. Yeah.
Okay.
It was,
so yeah. All my listeners, this is before. Remember, Sharon's a little bit older than I am.
Fuck you, Tracy.
We always like to say that.
One of our listeners has actually requested a t-shirt that says, "Fuck you, Tracy."
Oh, I love it. I think that would be so great. And people would be like, what's up with that? And so this was a little bit before my time. I had not come across Keith Green yet. So, of course, I would know this album later on. But at this time in 1977, I was not familiar with it.
Okay. What did you think when you first heard it?
Well, we'll get into that when I tell you about the first time I did hear him.
Okay. All right. So that was in 77. In August of 1978, they officially form the nonprofit 501c3 organization called Last Days Evangelical Association. That was the official, and actually it still is the official name of this, again, tax-free, folks. Oh my God, Don't even get me. I am not going to go down that rabbit trail, but
you can't. We'll save that for another time.
That'll be next year, maybe. Okay. And they expand with buying and renting more houses in that Woodland Hills, California suburb.
And they were purchased for the 501c3, do you know?
I have no idea if they were owned by the nonprofit or owned by Keith personally. I don't know.
Okay, so interesting. Also ongoing is the Whatever You Can Afford, Literature mm-hmm. and Concerts.
Right.
And sometime in 1978, they send out, publish the first newsletter magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And we have not been able to get a copy of that, Sharon. We went through stacks and stacks recently.
Right.
And the first copy was not there.
It wasn't. So yeah, anybody out there, anyone out there who has a copy or knows someone with a copy or even has photos of that very first publication, please share it with us. Please, please. We would be forever grateful.
Yes. And we think that in that was the first article for all of you track department workers out there, of which Sharon and I were. Number one track baby was
number one
by Charles Finney. I know it wasn't really number one, but it was number one, breaking up the fallow ground.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember getting this at some point. I must have gotten the track because I had to look up the word fallow.
Okay.
Because it's not a current modern word that you typically use, right? And Charles Finney, we're going to get into more about Charles Finney. But when we were going through all those stacks of tracks, you know, from the past, it was like Finney in one pile, then more, Finney, another one, Finney. It was like, oh, there's so much Charles Finney in all of those articles. And of course, breaking up the fallow ground is all about how your heart is hard, like a baked field sitting in the sun that you can't plant anything in, right? So you have to completely break up and pulverize the deepest level in order to be pleasing to God. That's kind of what it is. And levity.
Right.
Charles Finney was great with no levity, folks, because, you know, and I began to think about this. We had a recent conversation with someone on our last tour, Sharon. And they were like, oh, yeah, levity.
Wait, our last tour?
Our last tour, when you and I were singing together. No, we did the road trip together.
Our trip together. Okay, yeah.
Our trip together. We talked to somebody who also remembered how levity was just something we all were trying so hard not to.
Yeah,
not
to don't. Be. Don't you fucking smile, people. Don't you fucking smile. And all you have to do is look at Charles Finney's, the illustrations of him.
Yeah,
and
piercing eyes.
Yeah.
But I began to think, you know, it is kind of logical because if you really internalize and believe that the whole world and everyone you go to the mall and meet and that the stores are going to burn forever in eternity, if you really believe that, there's like, why are you having church picnics, dude? I mean,
you should definitely,
this is no picnic. You should be out making sure that all these people are getting saved. So,
yeah.
So I internalized that. I took it. It worked on me. Yep. Lowly, filthy, terrible worms that we were. That was Charles Finney's message for us.
And Keith, you know, that big, thick book, the autobiography of Charles Finney, which again, was it an auto hagiography, not a biography? I don't know. But my God, that was like right next to the Bible. And there are times I think that Finney's words were more important to Keith than the Bible. I really believe that.
Yes. I mean, I was laughing because, listeners, Sharon avoided having to go through the training school. That really thick book was required reading for us.
Oh, I read it. I read it before you did, woman. Are you kidding?
Okay.
In 1979, when I came, it was required reading for all of us. Yeah.
All right. I stand down. I stand down then.
Okay. But that whole message of unworthiness, I mean, it was perfect for damaged young people, because it's right in line with what our childhood traumas already taught us, right?
Yeah, and the Catholic faith, right?
And the Catholic faith, yeah.
We saw that as truth, and then we saw a lot of people not living it because people don't tend to live that out in most Catholic churches, at least at the time.
Right.
And so, damn it, we were going to do it,
Sharon. We're going to do it. And, you know, I think that a lot of the kids that were raised in IBLP churches, or, you know, I mean, pick any of these fucking extremist fundamentalist belief systems. And that's the message you're getting right from the beginning, right from the beginning. So,
yeah.
All right.
Sad now.
So I guess I would say my husband to be, but my later to be arranged husband, Martin, he had had this college job at a small print shop. So Keith bought this old two-color printing press and they set it up in the garage of one of the houses. And then another guy who was there was kind of a bit of a tinker, inventor sort. We sometimes called him the nutty professor, Wayne Dillard.
Oh my God. Okay.
He rigged up this homemade collating machine. And I think they actually used, some sort of like an egg beater motor or something ridiculous. But anyway, it was really this in-house or in-garage print shop was really a total do-it-yourself thing, like figure it out. And, you know, honestly, Tracy, in many ways, it was very impressive for this total mishmash ragtag group of teens and 20-somethings, you know, to develop and do these things.
Yes, and, yes, it was. And I think that's where, when we were talking earlier, where that nostalgia and the stuff that you look back is impressive, because somehow all of this zeal, right, of youth is harnessed. And it is amazing what young kids putting their heads together can
what we did. Yep. So here's another fun fact. So there was this one time that the printing press was acting up or something, and these sheets are coming out. They're coming throughout the other end, and there's like this triple image, like multiple impressions on it. So my yet to be later to be husband takes one of the worst of them, and he pins it up on the garage wall. And with a marker, he's got this big caption. It says "Pretty good printing!" Exclamation point.
Oh my God.
And so it becomes an inside joke, and that was later what all the copyrights said on the magazine and the tracks. You'll see it's a little circle C copyright, pretty good printing.
Oh my God. I never cease to learn things. I did not know that, Sharon. Obviously, I knew about pretty good printing, but I thought it was just a ha ha, we're trying to be humble, so we won't be great, right? Because you can never be great. You can only be pretty good. Oh, that's,
yeah, it was
not
fun.
Know that.
Yeah.
Which also just pisses me off that you and Martin had so much to do with the very foundations of this fucking ministry that you completely got left out of the book. And I know that is a rabbit trail, and we kind of mentioned it in other episodes, but it incenses me when I hear little stories like that.
I get it. And I would rather be out of it completely than misrepresented. So how about that? We can go with that. All right.
Okay. All right. So in 1978, this is all happening. God, a lot was happening in that year. Keith's second album, No Compromise, was released, also with Sparrow Records. And this is where I come into the Keith sphere.
Okay.
I was listening to the radio, actually on my way to a youth group event with a couple other from my youth group in the car. And, you know, I had gotten saved right about that time in 1978. And I was already finding myself at odds with some of the other church kids because they weren't radical enough for my taste, right?
Right.
You know, people who had grown up in the church, I don't know, they were there because their parents were made there. And of course, I was saved, right?
Radically saved.
And so when I heard his song come on the radio, immediately it was like he was singing my heart. And I was like, who is that? Who is that? Who is this person? And I think in the car, someone said, Green, something Green. And that was the first time I heard of Keith Green.
Okay.
And I also heard that he sent out a free, I don't think they said for whatever you can afford. I think they said free newsletter.
Uh-huh.
And so I immediately wanted to get a hold of how I could become a part of the mailing list.
All right.
Interesting.
Very good.
And so then, you know, in 1979, Sharon, you God, I don't know, what month in 1979 did you drop out of college?
Well, it would have been probably February is my guess. Actually, okay. Yes. You know what? It was, because that's when this, what was called the revival, was going on at Last Days in California. Okay. And I had reached out to Keith and he said, you got to come now, and got me a ticket. And I flew out. I think I flew out. I don't think it was a bus. And yeah, and was there. So it was right at that time, February of 79. Yeah.
Early 79. And so I kind of trailed off, but Sharon drops out of college and joins Last Days Ministries. Mm-hmm. Although I don't think you thought that you were joining, but, and we haven't really posted the letter, the infamous letter that sent that basically bears your heart out. So we'll make sure to post that in a permanent place that people can refer to, because it's very telling just about where you were at.
Right, because I had gone through a little bit of a, quote, backslidden stage, and then I'm overwhelmed with guilt, and I'm coming back to Jesus, and I'm writing to Keith, and yeah. So, yeah, I mean, from the very beginning, Tracy, of my relationship with Keith, and his influence on me, and then my visit, which turned into the moving, you know, the totally being there at Last Days from the beginning.
Which is so crazy, yeah.
The toxic guilt and shame, and the striving for holiness, and the never, never getting there. That's what Last Days was, honestly.
And you just fell in step with that, right? So like you, because I know we've heard a little bit of that story, but I guess I'm trying to get in touch with the teenage Sharon who goes to college, is definitely feeling backslidden. When you arrive at this place, because I guess I don't know how many houses there were at the time, can you remember at all like your initial like feelings or senses or what has happened when you arrive at this place?
Oh, I think I was so excited. I was just excited, right? I mean, there's all these teens and 20 somethings and we're all in it for Jesus and we're sacrificing and we're living in, we're going to be in these bunk beds and we're all working together. And it was exciting. It was, it was like, wow, this is where I belong. This is where I belong. Yeah.
And you came from a family with some money, right? You would probably call yourself upper middle class.
Oh, upper class. My dad was a surgeon. Yeah, definitely upper class.
So you're, you know, giving up some comforts, right? To live in bunk beds, and you never thought anything about that or.
Nope. It was the antithesis of, you know, my parents were financially successful, but my mom was a horrible alcoholic and my dad was absent and my brothers and sisters are kind of running amok and I wasn't happy and I didn't have friends. Well, I had Christian friends after I became a Christian, but still it was like, what's the point? What's the point of life? You know, so this was answering that question, what should you do with your life? And you give it all to Jesus. That's what you do with it.
Well, and I think you'll find interesting, as well as our listeners, if you haven't watched Brother Sun, Sister Moon, that is St. Francis' story. He comes from a lot of money, and you see him in one scene throwing out, right, all the bolts of very expensive cloth as he goes off to serve Jesus. So it's interesting. All right, continue on the bullet trail.
Okay. So I think it was maybe late summer. I'm not 100% sure about that, but it was 1979. We have the move to Texas. And we've already talked about that in some other episodes. So it's about 24 of us in total. For the most part, kind of keeping those people who could be useful and serve, you know, so it's becoming like a transactional thing. Like, what can you contribute?
And I've heard you mention that. Would you have explained it that way then? Or did see that? What would you have thought that was happening with the culling of the people?
Keith and Melody prayed and they followed what God told them. That was the answer to everything. Because you know what? You could not fucking admit, hey, this is what I think and this is what I want. Mm-hmm. Right? No, because you're not supposed to have any will of your own. It's all got to be, what does God want? What does God want? And you get to hide things from yourself and from other people by wrapping this stupid, ridiculous veneer of God is directing us. But I bought into it. I believed it then too, mm-hmm. you know? So that's how I would have described it back then.
So then the people who didn't make it, you would have said they didn't have what it takes. They weren't sold out enough, or maybe God really was leading them a different way.
Yeah. I think that would have been the explanation we would have given. You know, I don't know that I thought about it all that much.
Okay.
I wasn't that close to anyone.
Mm.
You know, I was kind of still in a bubble. It was me and Jesus.
Okay.
I didn't really relate to most of the sisters there. I didn't really have any close friends. And I guess my closest friend there was Keith, but you know, he's mm-hmm. busy. He's running a ministry. And frankly, I also realize in retrospect, you know, I'm a young, attractive, yes. you know, late teenager, and that's not going to be appropriate for him to hang out with me very much. Yes. So,
I have this very important question to ask you though. Did you wear deodorant?
Of course I did. And I washed my hair. Right. Silly girl.
We could really be questioning your devotion to Jesus then, couldn't we?
Oh, that is true. That is true. Oh. Yeah. But okay, so this move, right? This move from California to Texas. If you had skills that were useful, you know, if you really knew what you were doing with the printing or the equipment maintenance, of course, the artists. We had the guy, you know, Wayne is doing computer programming at that time. And the all-important servant's heart, you know, don't you just hate, I just hate that now, servant's heart, which means you're basically willing to do whatever you're asked, whenever mm-hmm. you're asked. And of course, the sisters who are going to do the cooking and the cleaning and any babysitting. And I think in general, if your personal needs were going to take up too much time, like counseling or hand-holding, you would need to be out. Now, mm-hmm. there were a couple of exceptions. And I think this is from the whole emphasis on the pro-life thing, right? So there were a couple of unwed mothers and their babies. And so I am going to give credit for that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not into, obviously, that whole pro-life manipulation thing that I got into. Oh, my God. But at the same time, this was not pointing at a woman and saying, don't you dare have an abortion and, you know, go off on your own and deal with having a baby. No, they actually did take in women and their babies. And so I'm going to give credit mm-hmm. for that for sure. But in the end, Last Days goes from a suburb, this hippie collection of houses and outreach to the community that was attempting to help people, to this more removed, pretty remote Texas compound that has business objectives. And those objectives are carried out through extreme servitude by the members. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you didn't keep a journal during this time at all.
I did not. That's another one of my failures. And I'm not as spiritual as you were.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, you know, as you're climbing into your bunk at night and you've given up college, like, did you ever think, well, it's just only going to be for a short time and I'll need to go do that? Or
no.
I guess at what point you just, I'm in it. I'm in it for life.
Oh, I think right from the beginning.
Okay.
I was in it.
Interesting.
Right from the beginning. Yep. Never thought of going back. Never.
And then you are an ox when it comes to working.
Thank you.
So I assume that Keith really noticed that and appreciated that. And I assume that you are already finding a lot of value in working long hours. And I think I remember you talking about being in the kitchen, but that was just for a short time. And then immediately, what were you doing in the houses before you went to Texas?
Well, when I first got there, yeah, I was in the kitchen because that's where everybody has to go to get crushed and pulverized and your will stomped out of you. And I really did want to do office work, which was like opening the mail and answering letters and stuff. But I don't remember when and how the transition took place. I'm sure I was still doing I'm sure I was still doing some of the more, quote, domestic things when we first got to Texas. But pretty soon, I was doing data entry because I was a fast and accurate typist. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I wound up doing mostly in the beginning was computer work. Yeah, mailing list maintenance and entering the donations and sending out thank you letters and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. So in early 1980, I would think that Keith recognizes your value and ultimately betroths you at 18 years old to one of the elders who's also of great value to the ministry. So, and he continues to be a Cupid to many of the young single people there. As a matter of fact, when we did our recent tour, we met some old people from the old times, and every one of them mentioned Keith's Cupid tendencies.
Oh, my God.
So it wasn't just, you know, a couple people here. I know that Melody mentions it in the book, but it sounds like it was like out of control. It's really it was. What it sounds like.
And you know what? It was out of control. And I just want to stop because I have always, I've sort of joked, oh, Keith's got a good heart. And, you know, he liked to play matchmaker, you know, like what is that, like a Yenta or whatever. And and Cupid and because he just loves, and it's, I do believe Keith loved people, but to say it's playing Cupid is wrong. That is not what it was. It was controlling and interfering and inserting himself and what he wanted and imposing it on the lives of other people. And there were some people strong enough to say, nah, 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 nah.
There were.
And in fact, I've heard from someone who was probably 19 or 20 at the time. And Keith was trying to set this guy up with Dawn, his foster daughter. She was only 16. She was a minor. And he's trying to make that happen. And of course, what happened with me, it was not just playing Cupid and trying to fix up a couple of friends. It was trying to tell people, this is what you should do. And it was not right.
Yeah. And it's so foundational cult behavior, right? And I think you're right. I think we kind of laughed it off. It's kind of been glossed over. And then you look at how you were influenced, unduly influenced by the leadership of this ministry, quote unquote, prophet of God. And yes, thankfully there were some people who were strong enough to withstand that. Mm-hmm. But I think everyone in every story that we've heard, it was hard to say no to Keith.
It was hard to say no to Keith. It was. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. So I'm engaged now. And because that happened really fast. He sets me up and 3 weeks later he gets me engaged. And so May of 1980, this is when Keith's third album, So You Want to Go Back to Egypt, is released. But this time it's on our own label, which of course we call it Pretty Good Records, just like Pretty Good Printing. Yeah. And this is the one where Keith decided it was going to be available to people for whatever they could afford. I mean, totally radical policy. We loved it. And we shipped that album out directly from our Texas commune.
Yes, and I am at my house in El Paso, and I am on this mailing list, and I send in the coupon, and it was for whatever you can afford. I remember sending in $5.
Wow.
And I don't know, an album probably was like $7.99. It was close to the retail value, but not all the way. And got that at home, and I, you know, had a little round turntable that I would close my door because, you know, my parents would never let me play this on the main stereo. And I remember the first time I wasn't wild about it. I thought it was a little odd, odd musically. I mean, I was trying to fight my natural love, which would have been Queen at the time or Meatloaf, and I wasn't allowed to listen to secular music. And so I thought it was a little odd. And I remember really trying to convince myself, this is great. This is great. Mm. Did you have any thoughts on, or were you just so into the Kool-Aid that it was amazing?
I was into the Kool-Aid. Oh, yeah, it was a great album. I mean, some of them I loved and some of them I really liked. But hey, it's all God and it's all good, right? That's, yeah. So the machine, the ministry machine, that is making this all happen, giving you the things you're ordering for whatever you can afford. We had a mandated schedule. We're told when to wake up. We get up at 7 a.m. and our lights are out at 11 p.m. And we have an enforced 8 in the morning till 9 in the morning individual quiet time every morning, right? Where you're only allowed to pray and read your Bible, nothing else. Then our work schedule was generally 9 in the morning till 10 at night. But if we had the newsletter coming out, we would go into what we called the burn schedule. And that meant you're often working 24, 36, even sometimes 48 hours straight.
Absolutely 48 hours straight. I think some people were pushing way longer than that, depending on your role.
Maybe so. We had mandated 24-hour fasting once a week. We were required to attend the Wednesday evening Bible study, usually led by Keith, sometimes by Martin, sometimes by Wayne, and often you were going back to work after that. The only day off we had was Sundays, and you were still encouraged to attend a local church or go to evangelize at a nursing home or do something else. And as would be expected in one of these high control groups, everyone except, of course, Keith and Melody is required to keep this schedule. And also, I'll note, I don't think Keith or Melody ever went to go do these mandatory evangelisms at nursing homes or things like that. I don't remember them going. I don't.
And I don't think we've spent enough time on that, because I know even when I came, they were exempted, and I never questioned their exemption. And I come from a pretty cynical family, and I've thought about that. Like, why did I not ever question that? And I think, well, they were one of the few married people with kids. So I think in my head, I was like, okay, well, they got to have that time to be with their kids.
Yeah, but there was more babysitting going on than there was time with their kids.
Okay, exactly, to your point. It's like, okay, I think in my head I said that, but they had people cleaning their house for them. They had people doing their yard work for them. They had people babysitting for them.
I know.
And I still, I mean, one of my early jobs, I do share this on another episode, I'm driving their son to school in the morning. And so, like,
because they're still in bed. Because they're still in bed.
In bed. And when I would get him, it was sisters in the ministry who were getting them ready for the day, giving them breakfast. And I'm surprised at me, Sharon, that I never questioned that enough. I was never cynical enough that it was different for the leaders.
Right. No, I'm with you.
All right. So that continues on as kind of the daily life at Last Days. And then April of 1981, that is when you have your wedding to the Elder Martin. Even when I read Elder Martin, it sounds so Mormon to me. It sounds so, so culty, which means you, Sharon, are now a leader's wife. Like, you kind of are taking a step up. I don't know if you felt that at all.
Yeah. Yes. But actually, before we really talk about any of that, I know this isn't in our bullet points. Can we talk about that letter you received and just shared with me a few hours ago? You sent me pictures of the pages. Can we talk about that now?
Yes, I think it actually fits in very well here because it's right on the time. It's right on the bullet point timeline, Sharon. So I will allow it.
Thank you. It's funny. It's happening in my body again right this minute as I'm getting ready to talk about it. All right. So there's this letter that someone shared with Tracy. Someone who had been at Last Days, both in California and in Texas, and then left. Actually, there were a few people. They all received this, in essence, a form letter with some little bit of personalization afterwards. And it was written in February of 81, and it was Keith apologizing, but also excusing some of the extreme behavior and hurtful stuff and everything. And Tracy, I think if we redact if we redact who it was to, I think we should post this letter. It's a couple of pages.
I would love to post it. Yeah.
Okay. So I read that letter that was shared with you that Keith sent out. Again, it was February of 1981. Again, went out to people that had left on, quote, not good terms. You know, that's kind of what, that's kind of what this group of folks was. And as I'm reading that letter, and Tracy, it's happening to me again right now as I'm talking about this, I'm feeling this response in my body, like this panic, kind of trauma response where my heart rate is going up, my breathing is shallow, I can feel my blood pressure rising, and I've got this like pain in my chest. And the timing of this is very interesting because there's something else going on. A number of things are contributing to this. I've got a friend who's currently struggling. She's been in a long marriage, hasn't been great. She's got kids, and she's realizing that she probably never really wanted to be in this marriage in the first place. Mm-hmm. Just through some circumstances, she felt trapped and like she had to do it. And she's starting to come to terms with it. And I'm talking with her and helping her. And of course, it's bringing up for me. And I'm remembering all the pain and the terror and the guilt when I was starting to contemplate leaving that very unhealthy marriage. And so, of course, my heart, I'm hurting with her. I'm empathizing with her. I remember the agony of that. And so this is what's been going on with me. And then I read this letter and Keith's, you know, apology. And he's referring to, you know, oh my gosh, we had these big changes in February of 79. And remember, that's about the time that I arrived and dropped out of college and stayed. All right. And he's talking about how we got rid of all these rules in 79. Of course, part of me is thinking, damn, there were still a lot of rules. If you got rid of them, if you got rid of them in that time frame, holy shit, it must have been horrible. And in this letter, he's talking about how, you know, he's realizing he was still too pushy and dictating into people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so this is now this new revelation that he's writing in February of 1981, all this stuff. And I'm reading his words and I'm thinking to myself, Tracy, I just was on the verge of tears and I wanted to cry. And this is what I feel right now, too. I want to just scream at him. Keith, if you're realizing that you shouldn't be pushing and dictating and playing puppet master with people's personal lives, why didn't you walk back that engagement that you arranged for me? Why didn't you say something like this before the wedding? Why did you go through with this? There would still have been time. And just, I'm surprised at myself, Tracy, at the anger and the fear and the pain I feel right now. And the way my body, you know, I'm learning to recognize when it comes up in my body. And there still is that thing of more than one thing is true at a time, right? I have my kids. I love my kids. If you gave me a magic wand right now to undo it and I wouldn't have my kids, I wouldn't take that magic wand. I would not take it. And it is true that it was horrible and horrific. And so reading this letter just brought all that up again for me. And I just thought the timing of it was very interesting.
Oh, I can totally see that. Yeah. No, and we will post it. As a matter of fact, maybe you and I can talk and we can read it and do a week following this bonus where we just read it.
Okay.
With the redacted parts out there, because I think it really does paint the picture of a pushy, demanding Keith who thinks he's apologizing. And all of us who knew Keith post this letter and last days post this letter, it's like, damn, I don't know what you're apologizing for, because a lot did not change. And
right.
I see that you know, even in this journey that you and I have been on, and I know from the early days of when you started going to work, when you were just what we would call deconstructing, it's been kind of ha ha arranged marriage, ha ha arranged marriage. And I think that this is definitely in pace with, it was, Sharon.
It was.
And yes, we made decisions and choices, but we made decisions and choices of young girls who were groomed, very groomed. And yeah. I don't think we have unpacked that to the degree that we should have or that you are unpacking now. So this completely makes sense to me that this letter would bring all that back up. And even on our recent tour, when we, you know, walked the property and went into that room where you had your wedding, mm-hmm. and then went on the property where the ranch house stood, and you remember as if it were yesterday, just the smell of the air, the nighttime, the fears of a young girl about to make, you know, the most impactful decision of your life, under what we would say is the duress and demands of Keith Green. And it's not overly dramatic. I think that when you don't understand what happens in these spaces, it can be very easy to gloss over. And wow.
Well, I'm very thankful to the person who reached out and shared that letter with you, because I think it is very revealing. And yeah, we'll do another segment on it. But in the meantime, shall we get back to era number one?
Yeah. I mean, this is part of the era. And I think the point of this person sharing it was lots of people ask, you know, would Keith have deconstructed? And it's like, we all apologize. We were conditioned to apologize. We apologize up one side and down the other. And to me, this letter is a sample of he's apologizing, but he doesn't get it.
He didn't get it.
He does not get it.
I think he was trying to mitigate some of the bad press and people talking about it.
I think so. And we can definitely go into a little commentary when we read it, because it's very telling.
We'll do that.
So back to all of that. And I do jokingly say, well, you kind of entered into leadership, because in that space, right, there is, you know, these tiers of privilege, these tiers of respect, these tiers of what we would call anointing. And so that was my question. Like, now you are now the wife of an elder, which puts you into what they called the leadership team.
That's right.
Was there any kind of, you know, instating you, anointing, public recognition, anything?
Don't remember that. I mean, the timing of the wedding itself was we were also in a burn for the newsletter. So
always romantic.
Always very romantic. But I don't remember. There might have been, but yeah.
Okay. I don't remember. And the reason, you know, which we'll go into on the letter is signed by Keith and the leadership team, right? So that would have included Keith and Melody, Wayne and Kathleen, and then just Martin, because Sharon hadn't entered into the picture yet.
Right.
So the leadership team, of course, Sharon was a part of it when I came. And I would say that Keith was very proud of his triune leadership team, right? I think because it's like the triune God. We have God, the Father, and the Holy Spirit. And it was like, we have Keith, we have Martin, and we have Wayne. And how they needed to do things in unison. And then, of course, they extended that leadership team to be the wives of those elders.
But only through marriage, only through marriage.
Only through marriage, right. And of course, you know, we love that word. I haven't heard this word in so long. Helpmeets, right? Oh. You guys were the helpmeets for your husband.
Oh, so, God.
You know, even though we were reading William and Catherine Booth, and Catherine Booth was active in ministry, it wasn't a spiritual leadership that was allowed, except for as submitted wives to the elder husbands as helpmeets.
Right. Gag me.
Yes. So after your wedding, all of this is happening. I don't know how long it was, but Keith then actually changes his will
Yes.
For you and Martin to be now the parents of his children if anything should happen.
Right. To him and Melody if they die. Yeah. I remember him coming and asking us, would we do that? Yeah.
That's heavy. That's a big.
It is.
That's heavy.
It is big. Yeah.
And then, of course, they had two at the time. And then the third child, Rebecca, is born in 1981.
Yeah. Melody was pregnant at the wedding. Yeah. All right. Well, okay. So, yeah, we've already mentioned that we're all working these crazy hours, 6 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day. And the demand for the literature is increasing. Keith is incredibly successful doing concerts. His albums are super popular. More and more people signing up for the newsletter. More and more people requesting tracks. So we have a staffing problem. How do you find the quote right people who have the quote right attitude? Okay. And of course, the right attitude equates to doing what you are told without grumbling and complaining, no different ideas, no different opinions. You put your head down and you do it and you be grateful for the privilege. You'll go into tight living conditions, no pay. Right. All this stuff. So like, how do you find people for that? How do you find people who will sign up for that kind
who
of thing?
Sing from their heart, burned out for thee, Lord, burned out for thee.
Right. Yeah. So here's another true story. Keith loved old black and white movies, right? So whether, all kinds of old black and white movies. So we'd be renting VHS tapes for, I think we watched them on Sunday afternoons or evenings, group viewing there in the ranch house. That was on our one day off.
And one day off.
And one of the movies was called The Green Pastures. It's from 1936. This is back when Hollywood was segregated. And this was an
I actually mentioned that movie in my interview with Troy and Brian.
Oh, yeah?
So significant. Yep.
Oh, yeah. Well, and any movie that we watched, we'd watch over and over again. So we'll put a link, right? We're going to put a link to that in our show notes. It's an all-black production, all-black cast. And there's a scene where God is looking for a recommendation from some of the angels to find a new leader on earth. And one of the angels asks, and it's very stereotypical, and this is the way it's done in the movie, does you wants de brainiest or does you wants de holiest, Lord? And then God answers, I want the holiest. I'll make him brainy. And this became an aha moment for Keith, for Martin, for Wayne.
Yes.
Because we couldn't necessarily rely on just finding the holiest people, but we could come up with a way to systematically groom young people to be even more self-sacrificing. And then once we're sure they have that right attitude, then we can train them in the jobs that we need done.
So burned on my brain.
I know.
Listeners, this was foundational to the ICT training. Foundational.
Right. So the summer of 1981, I think at this point that was mostly Keith and Wayne. Maybe Martin was involved, but again, Martin and I are really running the operational side of things. So the personnel stuff is probably more Keith and Wayne. And so they start looking over the format of the YWAM DTS. So that's Youth with a Missions Discipleship Training School. And that becomes the initial spark or the framework for our own school, which we called ICT, Intensive Christian Training School.
Intense.
We're going to find and we're going to make our own disciples. But Tracy, ours are going to be way more holier and way more extreme than YWAM.
Ding, ding, ding. Yes. That's how you got me.
That's how we got you, because you were extreme, girl. So January of 1982, that was the first term of ICT. And again, we're there to recruit more free labor without the problems of like the street people. And we're going to condition them in advance to be submissive, Tracy gets accepted to the first term ever, very elite. But Tracy, did you know that the ultimate goal was to make you a servant?
So this is where I have to give my quick backstory. I'm going to try to make this quick. So,
okay.
Yes, I had already graduated early from high school because Jesus was coming back, so I could serve God. So I had already been away for a year of what would have been my senior year serving God on the mission field in South Africa during apartheid, teaching the Zulu how to type, because I was already, like you, an award-winning typist, right? I was super fast. I think you are the only person who's actually faster than me.
Oh, Betty Daffin. No. Betty was the fastest.
Yeah. She was really fast. So when I had gotten back from this mission trip, I was like depressed. It was like, now I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I wouldn't have called it depression back then, but I was, I definitely felt lost and felt like my life needed to count for something. So there was a man who came from another community, which you probably don't even know that much about, but it's the Art Cats community in Minnesota called Ben Israel.
You're right. I don't. I don't know much about him.
And let me tell you the name, how fitting this is into my life. I was destined for this. The Art Cats Ministry's tagline was a rugged discipleship training camp for end time ministries. So guys, I'm like primed for this, right? So this man comes to my church in El Paso and he thinks there's so many, you know, worldly people going on. And he's talking about the school of the prophets and how that's really how God disciples his people. And he starts this small group within this church, of which I am one of them. And he starts to groom me. He's a 40-year-old man who very, very scholarly, right? Like he's the editor of our city newspaper. So he's no dummy. And he starts taking me out to lunch every day and calling me late at night. And
my parents are like, what? No,
you don't know anything.
I don't know any of this.
And we group start kind of breaking off from this church and we're starting to look for property to buy a house so we can start our own community.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And you know, great. I mean, there was a line that I wouldn't cross. So I don't know what his intentions were, but you know, he's picking me up for lunch. We're having deep theological conversations. It ultimately, you can read between the lines. It starts some church drama.
Oh my God.
There's some church drama in this, which the pastor gets involved in. Anyway, it's a split, a full on church split comes from this. I want nothing to do, you know, with that level of drama. So I start, you know, stepping back and then I'm reeling because it's like, this is exactly, he described everything that I wanted, the school of the prophets, this community where discipleship is everything. And what do you know, within a week or 2 weeks, what arrives in my mailbox but the Last Days magazines announcing their first intensive Christian training school
that's a
school for the heart and not just your head. Mm. And I'm telling you, I couldn't have been more primed for that.
Oh my God.
It was a pretty intensive application. I'm a fast typist. I typewrite 12 pages pouring out my heart and must have worked because I got accepted.
Wow. Okay, wait, Tracy. So your inner Jezebel was at the heart of a church split before you even got to Last Days? Is that your confession?
I mean, nobody knew about grooming back then, right? I look back and I'm like, holy shit.
Right.
This was so wrong. And I remember a meeting and his wife just with piercing, terrible eyes at him was just disdain for how much he was influencing the younger girls, right?
You know what, Tracy? Nothing new under the sun.
I know. Nothing new
under the sun. Wow.
So to answer your question, yes, I did know what I was getting myself into.
Okay. All right. So tell us about when you arrived.
Yeah. So Wayne and Kathleen Dillard, and I guess they, I don't know why they were chosen and not you and Martin, but you know.
Because Wayne was Dillard. Here's why. Wayne was truly a compassionate, caring guy.
He really was.
And Kathleen was an airhead spiritual nut. That's why.
you're gonna get shit from that from some people, but
well, if you think I should cut it out, I will. Or do you concur?
No. I'm just saying they became the leaders of the ICT, and I don't know if the first one. I don't know what the decision making is, but it was co-ed. We rented the house. If you're familiar with the Last Days property, there's the back gate that we talk about a lot. The house across from that back gate was rented as the eventually it became the Brothers Schoolhouse. But for the first ICT, it was the co-ed schoolhouse. And so there were 12 guys that were in three high bunks in the garage. And then we eight women had two bedrooms for each. And then the back bedroom with their own bathroom was Wayne and Kath. And that was the first school. All 20 of us, you know, cozy
packed up. In. Yeah.
Packed yeah. in. And, you know, when we drove up, I mean, you know, we talk about this in some other episodes, so I won't go into a lot of it, but there were definitely a heavy no levity thing going on. Like everybody was trying to be so serious for the Lord. It would take me several weeks before I even met you. So, you know, we had very similar schedule, but the morning time was class time, which really was video time. So you're paying money. We were paying money to go to this school.
And watch videotapes.
We're living, you know, I remember my first horror was fish stick soup because that was leftovers. That was our food. I was a little horrified, but I, of course, felt guilty for being so proudful that I think I deserved more. And we would have videotape classes a lot by the Youth with the Mission leaders that had been previously videotaped. And then, of course, the public confession, all of that. And then we would load up in the school bus to go work at the ministry.
That's
as
right.
part of our training.
Afternoons working. Yep.
Now, yes. And
Keith actually came and taught live, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So we did have, you know, I mean, but we had... what was it? 2 hours every morning. And so he wasn't going to.
Of course not.
He wasn't even up most of the morning. So yeah.
That's right.
So I think that he did come. He did greet us. You know, he did mingle with us just a little bit. And then we would go over to the ministry. And that's where he was still, you know, bebopping around the ministry when we were working. And I think it took me a couple weeks before I think I even met you. And of course, it was down by the horses. But let me just say, listeners, there was this mystique around Kathleen and Sharon. Now, of course, Melody was kind of known, but, you know, she was off at the house, didn't see her even then, even when Keith was alive, didn't see Melody around the ministry, hardly at all. But Kathleen and Sharon were like what we aspired to. They were these young, kind of hippie-esque, godly women who had somehow married, been, you know, gentle, quiet spirit, all that shit that we lauded back then to become wives of the elder. So I was very in awe of you, Sharon.
Wow. That feels so weird. It feels so weird to hear you say that. So,
yeah. So there, you know, it was a lot of, you know, even in segueing back to the letter, right? So this letter... that was
you're talking about the letter that Keith, the apology letter from Keith.
Yes, the apology letter that Keith wrote
in 81
on behalf of all of the elders at the time, was apologizing for all these rules. I'm telling you, when I came, there was a fuck ton of rules. and rules like you can't talk after 10. And I, at that time, thought that was a suggestion. keep it quiet. But it was like, no, you can't even mouth like, can I get my laundry? You can't. No talking. And if you talked, you got what these things were called sanctions, where in school, we didn't work Saturday afternoons, but if you got sanctions, you had to work Saturday afternoons. So there was a lot of rules still happening in the time period after supposedly all the rules fell away.
Right.
So I don't know what that was all about.
Okay. Well, I don't remember the timing. So ICT started January 82.
Yep.
And at some point in 82, I think it was early, but I don't remember exactly when, we take the trip to Europe. So that's Keith and Melody and me and Martin. And Keith had spent several weeks talking to me and Martin and saying, hey, guys, you know, I want to go to Europe. because I owe Melody a vacation. So, but come on, because it's not going to be any fun without you guys. You guys got to come. I don't want to go alone. So, which is actually kind of weird now that I think about it. I'm thinking about it's this so right now weird. For the first time.
It's so weird. But telling. Weird, but telling.
Weird, but telling. And it also got spun a little bit because we hadn't really had a honeymoon. You know, we'd gotten married the year before, but we're working. So it got like, okay, this could be a bit of a honeymoon. But the whole thing, of course, got hijacked by YWAM. We wind up visiting all these YWAM bases and the Anastasis and blah, blah, blah. However, I mean, Tracy, I was all in. I bought into it. I got into this whole thing of, yeah, missions for Jesus. We got to bring the gospel to the world. And when we got back from that trip, I wrote an article. I wasn't asked to write it. God, it's so embarrassing. This was what was on my heart. This is what I thought God was saying.
It was on my heart.
So I write out this article. I think I originally called it, Should a Christian Go to College? And it was my manipulation, diatribe, self-righteous, whatever the fuck, all those things about how I thought, yeah, when you get out of high school, because you got to do that, you shouldn't be going to college. You need to go to the mission field. And, you know, I learned well from Keith. I mean, manipulate and make guilt trips and all this sort of stuff. And anyway, I wrote this and I remember bringing it to Keith and showing it to him and being a little bit worried about it. And Keith took it and he read it. And then we have a meeting. And I remember Keith specifically saying to Wayne, this is the heart of what God is saying now to all of us. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I have this sense that I don't know how much of a role it did or didn't play in Keith also just jumping on the whole missions bandwagon, or we were all there together or whatever. Because remember, he was actually doing the songs for the shepherd thing, which was all about more grace and worship and blah, blah, blah. Right. Anyway, I don't know, but it's all tangled up. And
Sharon, we had already been living that. I mean, you were living that. I was living that. I mean, when we talked earlier about these young people coming together, none of us had been to college. I mean, very few, very few had actually done a stint in college. And so we absolutely swallowed the God can make us brainy, right?
Yeah.
For whatever we might need. And so why would you waste those years when people are dying now?
Right.
Going to hell. I mean, it makes some logical sense if you buy the premise.
Yeah.
And the whole missions, remember, I'd already been to the mission
field. Yeah. You win. You get another point.
I was actually really on board because it was like, okay, that's one thing. Get the church, you know, saved and right. But then for what? You got to send them out. So
yeah,
I think we were all in it together, all of us, Sharon.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then you of course get accepted to second term, right? Even more elite.
Yeah, no, that was before the Europe trip. So, you know,
ICT really?
January of 82.
Okay.
Second term was at the end of March and April, where we actually did the crusades, and we were the prayer group of, you know, for the Inquirer's meeting that Keith was trying to relive Finney's book, that big thick book he was trying to live that.
Right.
And so that was already over. So your trip to Europe must have been in either the end of May or June.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is so bizarre. It's like, that means there was like hardly any time at all between that Europe YWAM trip and the crash.
There was hardly any time.
Well, you know what it was? It's last day's ministries time, because a day A day is as a thousand years.
That's what I was thinking. Yes. I mean, and that would come up when my, you know, family would have birthdays and I'd completely forget, because every day when you're working that long, you lose, you know, everything seems to take a lot longer.
Oh my God.
Wow. And also on that missions trip, let's not gloss over Youth with a Mission's grooming of Keith that is happening on that trip as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, because I don't think you guys went into the highways and the byways to see the poverty of poverty, right? You went to fucking
Europe. No. We were in Amsterdam. We were in Lausanne, Switzerland. We were in Athens, Greece. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you guys come back with this terrible burden as you've been touring Europe.
Right. Right. So think about it. I mean, you've got Floyd McClung and Don Stevens and whomever else. And are they living and helping people in really the depths of poverty and deprivation in India or Africa? No, they're in these lovely westernized cities and upscale stuff. I mean, that's the truth of it. That's the truth.
That is the truth of it. And of course, now in hindsight, we can see why it was quite the recruiting tool to have Keith Green on board with your mission, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, it was. And so much that got done then, May and June and July. Holy shit.
And even before the plane crash, there was a pretty astounding 250,000 person mailing list that was a clean mailing list.
I'm going to say this again for people who don't really get it. We did not, Last Days Ministries did not solicit donations. So you got this newsletter in your mailbox, however often we sent it out. You could get tracks for whatever you can afford. You could get an album, one per household, for free if you needed it. We were not soliciting. So we had this sterling reputation. I mean, there's no other ministry in the country, maybe even in the world, that was operating that way. Of course, we were able to do it because of slave labor, but that's another thing. But because of that, this list, and it was clean because once a year, if we had not heard from someone, so that's what that whole mailing list maintenance was, you know, if you wrote to us in any way whatsoever, we'd put the date in of your last correspondence to us, whether it was a donation or a request for literature or just a thank you letter. Didn't matter what it was, your record would be updated. If we had not heard from you in a year, in 12 months, we would send out a little postcard that just said, hey, just wondering, are you still there? Do you still want to receive our stuff? We need to hear back from you. Otherwise, we'll take you off the mailing list. So,
Sharon. Oh my God. I just thought of this just now. So I was off doing God's work missionary in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And that postcard came while I was away.
Really?
And my dad writes to me in the letter and he goes, oh, Tracy, you didn't take care of your business, because he always looked for opportunities to tell me how irresponsible I was. You didn't take care of your responsibilities. I'll have to look it up and see what adjective he used. But that newsletter is going to expire, but your old sinful dad went ahead and sent it in for you so you wouldn't have an interrupted mailing. Oh, it's so funny. I have that in a letter.
Oh my God. Yeah. So this list was astounding. There was nothing like it in the history of Christian ministry ever. Astounding. Okay, yeah, I interrupted.
But it would go on to be, you know, 450,000 to 500,000. I don't know what month or year it happened. But another fun fact, I was actually doing a seminar trying to figure out a way to program our stickers, our mailing labels, so that we didn't have to put all those stickers on. If you remember state stickers and regional stickers of that, you could actually program it into the actual mailing list label. So I was at this seminar trying to learn how to do that to save steps, because that's what we do. Always be efficient. And I was sitting next to Highlight Magazine and Reader's Digest. So here I am, Last Days Cult Girl, sandwiched between these two very well-known publications.
Wow.
And they were astounded at our mailing list when I gave them those numbers. Like, they could not believe how hard they had to work to even get that kind of readership. So fun fact.
Okay.
All right. So big, clean mailing list, lots of money in the bank. The donations are flowing, because I think people love that, right? Whatever you can afford. We're not we're not out there begging for cash. And it was rolling in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the plane crash happens, which we go into great detail on episode 14. So this would be a good time, if you haven't heard that, to pop over and listen to that.
Episode 14.
All of this, so everything that we've gone through, and Sharon, drumroll, you just turned 21.
21 years old. And Tracy, you were 18!
18 years old. And, you know, trying to work my way up to become as godly as Sharon and worthy of being on the leadership team.
And then you'd eventually become co-director of ICT.
It worked, Sharon. It must have worked.
Oh my God, Tracy, we were 21 and 18 when the plane crashed. That is just,
it is.
That's crazy.
It's
crazy.
It is.
So I guess that pretty much sums up that first era, Keith Green burning bright. Yeah?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, it definitely is a very distinctive era. And of course, you go back a little further with Keith than I go back. But in that, you know, that timing, because people were like, well, you just came in January, he died in July. Like, yeah, but that was an intensive 6 months being immersed into the whole vibe of Last Days Ministries, the direction of Last Days Ministries, and seeing Keith and how active he was in molding and shaping and the direction and everything.
And a single day is as 1,000 years.
It was so true.
It was so true. Tracy, I got one last thing here.
Is this a rabbit trail?
Well.
Or is this an ox? Rut, an ox ditch.
Oh, the ox. What would be the wagon?
A ditch.
Ruts in the road.
Ruts in the road.
Okay. Yeah, or the ox in the ditch. Well, it actually happened just a couple days after we were there in Texas at the Last Days trip, you know, earlier this month. Oh my God. We are recording this on April 21st, and that was what, April 5th? So it's, you know, just a couple weeks ago. Anyway, okay. So this happened right after that trip, you know, visiting the property in Keith's grave. And okay, listeners, you may recall from that last episode that Tracy and I sat together at his grave, and we were right next to Keith's headstone and recording our thoughts in real time. And right before we had started recording that, my husband, Dave, we asked him, hey, take a few pictures of us, which he did. And then he went off for a walk to give you and me privacy so we could just be there together.
Good Dave. Good old Dave.
Good Dave. He's wonderful. And then later on, when we looked at the photos, we saw that on the last two of them, there was this glowing yellow and orange spot directly over Keith's name. And it was like this odd sun refraction in the camera lens or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so that was Friday afternoon, April 5th. And honestly, Tracy, I didn't even think any more about it, right? Because we're tired, we're exhausted, and our schedule's packed. And on Saturday morning, we get up and we're visiting some other old friends in the area of Last Days. And then we're driving back to the Dallas airport that afternoon, evening, and we're recording as we go. You fly up to Indiana that night. Dave and I stayed in Texas because we had some family and friends flying in. Because we're all going to go try to experience the total solar eclipse, you know, chasing
the eclipse.
Yeah, getting into the path of totality. So one person who flew in that night and joined us, well, she's become quite a good friend in the past couple of years. Her name's Karen Rolfe. She's this wonderful, amazing horse person with an international platform. But she's not just an equestrian. She just is a really deeper thinker about bigger life stuff. I just love her. And I'll put some links to her stuff in our show notes. So anyway, we've rented this behemoth of a vehicle. It's like I think it was called the Grand Wagoneer. It's this giant thing. And Karen and I are sitting in the way back on Sunday morning as we're driving from Dallas up north into Arkansas. And we're talking about all kinds of things in our life, you know, our journeys, family stuff and like life purpose and rethinking things and meaning and ayahuasca experiences and spirit guides. And I also told her about, you know, Tracy, remember that event you and I attended years ago that we nicknamed our seance, where it's contemplating
seance in Philly. That is a good story for another time. Not a rabbit hole now, but we'll definitely have to follow back on that one.
Okay. Okay. But it was like past lives and purple spirit guides. And anyway, okay, you're right. Another time.
We were searching.
Fair enough. So anyway, I'm telling Karen about how you and I had just visited the Last Days property the couple days before. And I'm telling her also about all these emotions that I experienced first standing where that old ranch house had been.
Yeah, the location where Keith had set your engagement. And
yeah, right.
It was powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And then when we walked into the big room with the fireplace at the Brown's house.
Yes. And I have posted some pictures of the room then and the room now. But, you know, like I said, I wish we had been alone and you could have had some more of that moment.
I do too. And then driving on the way back to the airport, we didn't have time to stop, but we're driving on I-20 and we see the sign for Lake Tawakani or Tawakani. Oh, yeah. And I'm remembering that first night of my honeymoon, you know, and all the dissociated pain and the trauma and just the numbness of that.
Yeah. And we will put some of those links. Also, we touch a little bit on it during our Virgins and Volcanoes, but
yeah. Yep. Yeah. So anyway, I'm telling Karen about this question that many folks have asked us, like, if Keith had lived, would he have moderated or would he maybe even have deconstructed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So many people ask that all the time.
Yeah. So I pull out my phone to show Karen the photos that we took on that visit, you know, the whole collection of them. And I'm scrolling through and I point out to her that photo of us at the grave with that glowing multicolored spot directly over Keith's name. And we both get really quiet. And then Karen says, you know, I've done a lot of photography over the decades and I've seen lots of lens flares and spots and stuff. And this one seems quite unusual. So I sit there, I'm just quiet and I'm looking at that photo. Mm-hmm. And Tracy, what just instantly drops into my mind is something that I've never contemplated before. And it's like clear and sharp. And it's this picture of an older Keith looking into my eyes and saying, Sharon, I'm so sorry that I did that to you. I'm so sorry.
Wow.
And maybe and probably it's just my own imagination, right? But whether it was simply that, or whether it's something more, or whether it's something of the connectedness, you know, that interweaves us all together, mm-hmm. whatever it was, or whatever it wasn't, I felt a sense of healing in those words at a profound level that I haven't experienced before.
Wow. And the rabbit hole that I said we wouldn't go down with that past lives, that's the whole point of that, is how do you find healing from the other side?
Yeah.
And I don't think you and I have all the answers to that at all.
No.
But I think when tangible healing takes place, that's something you have to take note of.
Yeah. It's interesting because reading that letter earlier today of the apology that wasn't enough, that actually felt very wounding all over again. So I'm going to have to spend some time kind of sitting with all of this and sitting with it and see where it all goes. But back to that question that so many people do ask, I don't know if Keith would have shifted and matured all that much, or if he would have just gone deeper and harder into the extremism. And I mean, we know Melody certainly has doubled down in favor of the hard religious right.
So wild, yes.
So for now, I'm just going to have to hold in my heart that image at his grave, that flare of sunlight hovering on his name, and the possibility of his words telling me he's sorry, and the reality of the letter where, that sorry wasn't quite enough.
You have to think, like I said, and we'll circle back with the audience to see where this goes, but obviously that letter was still written from very young Keith. Like, I think I said, he's apologizing. He doesn't have a fucking clue for what he's apologizing for. No. And you hope that by the time we talk about him being 70, and we hope that by the time somebody reaches that with grown children and just the pathways of life, that he would come into more balance.
You would hope.
And I think that's what's so upsetting about Melody Green, and frankly, my ex, as I've shared on different types of, you know, posts, is because deep in my heart is like, they should fucking know better. Like, you're older now. Like, you don't have the kid's brain. Like, you've lived some life. Like, why can't you know better?
That's right.
So yeah, I'm here with you. And I haven't posted that particular picture because, and now I'm probably going to have to post it because we're talking about it, but I haven't. I know that you and I can tend to look at signs. I know that many of our listeners, right? We've been spiritual since we were knee-high to a grasshopper. Mm-hmm. And signs have always been something that, you know, we've taken note of. And so I'm a little cautious with that, to be honest.
I agree. I agree.
But there's no denying the symbolism of that picture couldn't have been crafted better if we tried it.
That's true.
I mean, there's like obviously three names on the headstone. The only one that has the orb is Keith. We're right there at this very emotional time, sharing on his grave. And there's a fucking orb right on his name. And no one planned that. And I was like, okay.
No one planned it. All right, Tracy, I have a really important question to ask you.
Okay.
Or shall I say, maybe it's a statement to make for you to confirm or deny. I'm assuming that you have not yet read the Harry Potter books I gave you for Christmas.
Is it confirmed?
Confirmed. Okay.
I barely have time to go to the bathroom. But
I know.
Okay.
I know. But you have seen? Have you seen all the movies or most of the movies?
I think yes, I have seen it all, and I have at least one child who is a Harry Potter trivia expert. So I get it.
Near and dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. Okay. There is this wonderful exchange between Dumbledore and Harry in that last movie. I can't remember if the dialogue is directly from the book or if it's modified for the script. I don't know. So Dumbledore is already dead and Harry has just been struck with Voldemort's killing curse. And the two of them are in this vast, endless, blank white space and talking about what has happened. And at the end of this scene, Dumbledore tells Harry he has a choice to go take a train onward or to return to the battle currently raging at Hogwarts. And as Dumbledore begins to walk away, Harry calls out, "Professor, is this real or is it all just happening in my head?" And Dumbledore answers, "Of course it's happening in your head, Harry. But why on earth should that mean that it's not real?" And that's what I think about the orb and Keith saying sorry. And I will find the meaning in it for me. That's what I think.
Well, I think that's a great place to end.
Yes, it is.
Yep.
So you want to sum it up for us, Tracy?
Yeah. I mean, I think when we talk about complexities and things, two things being true at the same time, I mean, I think we've had to come to grips with Keith Green was a cult leader, whether he plotted it all out insidiously or not, it did become a cult. Last Days was a cult with all the earmarks and all the you know, the control and the sense of emptying out people's personalities to become something that we were all striving to be. So, yeah. And so we were, you know, classic followers, right? With our own trauma coming in to try to fill places. And we all eagerly drank the Kool-Aid. I think it was a slow and steady morphing. I know it was for me. I think it was for you too. We definitely believed that we were laying down our lives for Jesus, but it took on a pretty stark and alarming model of what that began to look like. And Keith was the leader of that pack.
He told us exactly what to do and how to do it. So yeah, last days may have started out with a focus of loving the unlovable and helping the needy and sharing the good news. And it morphs more and more and became all about pointing a finger at the church as a whole and at Christians as individuals, including ourselves, right? How we were never obedient enough.
Especially ourselves.
Yeah. Never sacrificing enough. Definitely not holy enough. Just all around. We were not enough.
Yep. And I mean, that is part of what led us there in the first place, right? We've seen that too true for too many people. It's the bringing our own trauma into another stew of different trauma.
Right.
So that wraps up era number one, which is Keith Green blazing bright, because, you know, I think it was his charismatic, blazing personality that drew both you and I, Sharon, and so many others, right? How many? 150 eventually? And then hundreds of thousands from the message into other avenues of ministry, right? Trying to live up to this idea of what it meant, like Keith, to follow Jesus.
By now, Tracy, I'd say millions. I have no doubt. Millions of people impacted. Yeah.
Yes. So in our next episode, we're going to cover era number two, the reign and regime of Melody Green, and maybe how some of that story of Keith Green may have been embellished just a bit to add to those millions.
Just a tad. All right. As always, folks, we really appreciate each and every one of you. And here's how you can help us. If you enjoy this podcast and feel it could be helpful to others, please rate us, whatever platform you're listening on, leave a comment, and share a link with your friends.
Yes, because Sharon, it's not even for what you can afford. It's free.
It's
zero.
Free.
Nothing.
Free.
Nothing. We charge nothing. I just had to add that in.
Okay.
Remember, we're also on Instagram, which also feeds into our Facebook stories with all the cool photos and pics and memories that we talk about here. That's Instagram at feetofclay.cultsisters.
Finally, we have a listener group on Facebook that you can join. It's called Confessions of the Cult Sisters Community. And you can read stuff and you can share with us and share with others who are also on this journey of discovery and healing.
So thanks so much for joining us. And until next time, bye, bye, bye.
Wait, Trace, who sang that song? Was it Britney Spears?
Bye, bye, bye. I think it was her lover, Justin Timberlake. Bye, bye, bye.
I have no idea. I'll look it up.
Oh, maybe NSYNC. NSYNC. Justin Timberlake was part of NSYNC. I might have that wrong. We're not the trivia girls. If you missed that episode, we'll put that link in our show notes. Don't trust us when it comes to music. Bye, bye, bye. Bye, bye, bye.